6. So the last time we started to talk about neutron stars, we discussed how one can derive masses very precisely when we just need to implement general relativity, and from that we can infer the masses of pulsars to very high precision. So this has been done for the Hals-Taylor pulsar, for example, to a precision of 4 or 5 digits. So very precise mass measurements are possible for pulsars because of the effects from general relativity. So today, are there any questions about the last lecture? No? So we are going to discuss now, what about radius measurements? Let me close the windows. What about radius measurements? Now, it turns out that measurements of radii are notoriously difficult. And there have been partly outrageous claims in the literature about the radius of neutron stars. But all of them are model dependent, very much. And sometimes the models are very crude, and one doesn't really understand them, makes simplified assumptions, and one gets a radius. So what's the problem with radius measurements? Principle should be very easy. It has been done for white dwarfs, so we can just transfer what has been done for white dwarfs also for measuring the radius of neutron stars. So radius measurements. So one thing we can do is just infer the Stefan-Boltzmann law. The Stefan-Boltzmann law in astrophysics is the following, that one looks at the luminosity. The luminosity of a star, this is energy per second. So that's the total energy emitted from a body per unit time. And the luminosity is usually denoted as L. And the total energy emitted per time should be proportional to the surface temperature to the fourth power times the Stefan-Boltzmann constant. That's the Stefan-Boltzmann constant. And it should be also proportional to the whole surface we see from Earth. So it should be proportional to 4 pi r squared times the Stefan-Boltzmann law. So usually if you go to normal physics, terrestrial physics, not really astrophysics, and sometimes one just denotes this as the Stefan-Boltzmann law, so that the energy emitted from a black body goes like the temperature to the fourth power with some coefficient. Nevertheless, in astrophysics, it's really this formula, 4 pi r squared times the temperature to the fourth power, which is called the Stefan-Boltzmann law. And just as a side remark, but you probably know that, the first name of Boltzmann is, of course, not Stefan, it's Ludwig. Ludwig, right? Ludwig Boltzmann. So Stefan is another guy. So, and sigma. So let's put this into a box. This is an important formula. So sigma is the Stefan-Boltzmann constant. Stefan-Boltzmann constant. And R is, of course, the radius. T is the temperature. L, the luminosity. Did I not? Let's write it down. Radius. And T is the temperature. So that would be the case if we just have no effects from general relativity. Now, in general relativity, we know that, for example, that if we measure a photon energy when traveling outwards in a gravitational potential is getting redshifted. So that means if we measure, for example, the maximum of the temperature of the spectral distribution of photons coming out from a black body, which has mass, it will be redshifted by the gravitational potential. That means that the temperature we're measuring is not the normal temperature, it's an effective temperature. Or better to say, it's the temperature measured from an outside observer at infinity, T infinity. Okay. So this is the temperature measured at infinity, basically in flat space. And asymptotically flat space, this is the temperature measured. The same, of course, holds for the radius. If we have photon trajectories coming from the surface, and it will be straight lines, of course, we're measuring at infinity the same radius as it is really there. But if the trajectories get distorted and bended, we measure a different radius. Actually, you can imagine if you just look at a sphere that photons from the backside just get bent by the gravitational potential and can reach the observer. So we can even look at the backside of a neutron star due to the bending of light. That means our infinity will be larger than the true radius of a star. So what we measure is the radius measured at infinity. At infinity. And that means we measure also the luminosity at infinity, although this really, as we have energy conservation, the energy emitted per second shall be the same, of course, except when the time clock is going differently, then of course the luminosity will be different. Good. Okay. So what we have is that, of course, the temperature and the radius will be modified from GR. So GR tells us the following, that R infinity is the true radius modified by the Schwarzschild factor. So it's 1 minus 2 GM over R times minus a half. And this is just a prefactor in the Schwarzschild metric, right? And a similar factor we have for the temperature. So what else do we need? What we measure on Earth is actually not a luminosity, it's the flux. Flux, which corresponds to the energy per second per unit area. Yeah, it's just we have a detector which has a certain area, and within that area we measure what is getting in energy per second. We do not measure the whole sphere around the neutron star emitting all the luminosity. So we can't really measure the luminosity. We can infer the luminosity by assuming that the radiation is isotropic in all directions the same. So the flux is basically just this prefactor here, right? So it's sigma Stefan Boltzmann times the temperature infinity to the fourth power. So this is on Earth, so this would be at infinity. And then we know it goes like 4 pi r squared, r infinity squared. And then it goes over the distance squared. Yeah, and the picture is the following. So d is distance to Earth of the neutron star. So the picture is the following. So here we have the neutron star. neutron star, and that has a radius r, okay, or r infinity as measured from us. And then this area we're measuring is 4 pi r squared, and this one here, so this is r, and this is the distance d. Yeah. And of course, the relative flux we measure the flux will go down. The flux will go down like 1 over d squared. Yeah, when we measure a smaller and smaller area, we are going to measure basically an area which goes down like 1 over d squared. And the relative ratio of the energy emitted here and the energy emitted here is given by this factor relative to the per unit area which we advocate here. Okay. It's just the relative areas, basically, we are going to compare with. Good. So this is what we measure. The temperature we can measure from the profile. R infinity is what we want to have, and what else we need is just d, the distance, and then we have it in principle. Okay, so the recipe is the following. Measure distance, measure d, for example, by parallax. Parallax measurements. So this will be only possible for nearby neutron stars or white dwarf, and usually the maximum distance we can have is at the order of 1 kiloparsec or a few kiloparsec. So there are satellite missions. Does anybody know any satellite missions measuring the parallax from your astronomy classes? Yeah, an optical. But they're specially tuned. They are designed to measure parallax. Of course, they're very faint objects. One needs the Hubble Space Telescope. So if you really want to observe something which is 10 kilometers in size, that flux is very, very low. So this is at the limit even of the Hubble Space Telescope. So Hubble Space Telescope has seen an isolated neutron star being 117 parsec away. I think I mentioned that in the previous lectures. So within 100 parsec, they can even do a parallax measurement. So they measured it's about 100 parsec, 120 parsec away, that neutron star. It's the closest one known. And if you want to measure white dwarfs, for example, or ordinary stars, there's this Hipparchos satellite mission in the 90s. And the new mission is Gaia. And they're measuring millions of stars. So basically 10% of all the stars in the galaxies they want to map out, measure the parallax and the spectrum. Anyway, but the problem with Gaia is, of course, the sensitivity. They will not be able to really measure neutron stars unless they are very close by, say within, I don't know, must be really close by, yeah, and bright. Okay, so the second thing, measure the flux. F infinity. And then the problem is we measure R infinity. So measure flux. From the spectra. Yeah. In principle, this would be a relation which is integrated over all frequencies, but you can also do a cut and then the fluxes are then frequency dependent. You can also implement that one here in a more general formula. So in principle, we can measure T infinity or say the flux which we have initially for a given frequency. So, however, when we measure, now we have determined R infinity. Now the problem is with R infinity, it's basically a function of R and M. So if I look at it, it looks like the following. So let's look, make a plot, M versus R, the radius. And then we need one line for black holes. This goes like this. Here the radius is the Schwarzschild radius 2gm. So here we have black holes. We cannot go beyond this limit. So this would be Schwarzschild black holes. If we have a Kerr black hole, this would be here at maximum rotation. So this is the regime of black holes. Actually, this is interesting. So we really, for black holes, we just have this area here, where R is equal to GM. This is for maximally rotating Kerr black hole. So black holes can only be in here. Nothing can exist here, actually. Not even black holes. Unless they don't have a horizon. Okay. Anyway, so if I look at this formula and make plots for different R infinity, it basically goes like this. So for very small R, this goes like R. So this goes like this. And then it reaches a certain radius. Goes down like this. And the value we have down here, this is R infinity, which we measure. So R infinity is larger. The true radius is something smaller, somewhere. But it depends on the mass of the star. This is R infinity 1, R infinity 2, R infinity 3. Okay, sketchy. Yeah. So there have been fits to the spectrum, assuming a black body. And then what they get out are basically these banana shapes. So when they measure R infinity, they can make a determination of basically a certain region which fits. So basically, most of the time, they measure something like that. So from the isolated neutron star RxJ 1856, they measured R infinity, and they claim that R infinity is larger than, I think it was 14 kilometers. So this was more on the high side. But there has been also claims for another nearby neutron star where they claim that the radius is, it was actually the pulsar in the supernova remnant of 1181, where they measured R infinities only 6 kilometers. So strikingly different things. The problem is that this is too simple. Too simple. So if I do a naive fit, then I get sometimes outrageously small radii. The problem is, and it's known actually, for a hydrogen atmosphere, if one does a model now for a detailed hydrogen atmosphere taking into account opacities, for example, one finds that the radius measured from a black body is about a half times the true radius. So instead of 6 kilometers, this should have been more like 12 kilometers. Nevertheless, there was a claim then even by the NASA from 2002 that they measured a quark star because the radius was 6 kilometers. Now you can imagine if R infinity is 6 kilometers, then the true radius is something like 4 to 5 kilometers. This is outrageously small. It's actually so small that even a quark star must have a mass which is below 1 solar mass, which is hard to get in core collapse supernovae. So in core collapse supernovae, we usually get masses above 1 solar mass. Okay, the hope was now we can do something what we did also for white dwarfs. We need to have some additional measurement. need more data. So one thing is measure spectral lines. Yeah. And then we get a gravitational redshift. We know that delta lambda over lambda is about the compactness of the star, gm over r, which is just a 1 plus the redshift. Yeah. And if we take unusual values for the compactness of the star, we know that typically, we have discussed this, the redshift or the compactness is about 0.2. It's not one, right? It's just the redshift. 0.2 is the compactness. Yeah, and then maybe for quark stars, it could be 0.3 or 0.35, but not much more than that. We discussed also the Buchdahl limit and the other ones. The limit for black holes is a half, by the way. So this is a typical redshift we can expect, not much more, maybe 0.1, maybe 0.3, but in this ballpark. And what have we seen? The measurement. So one can look at the flux. Measured versus the temperature versus the frequency. That doesn't matter, frequency or temperature. Frequency. And it really looks like a black body. This is for an isolated neutron star 1856. And it turned out to be, so these were the data points. Perfect black body. Perfect black body. And the temperature they measured was about 50 electron volts. They inferred from the maximum. So 50 electron volts corresponds to a temperature of about 500,000 Kelvin, half a million Kelvin. So this is even 10 times, or 50 times more than a typical white dwarf, which has about 10,000 Kelvin. It's two orders of magnitude higher than the surface temperature of the sun. So that temperature is huge. And the reason is that this is a pretty young neutron star. So if you catch a neutron star within the first million years or so, it's still hot, and you see it. Afterwards, it becomes a black star, basically. And we can't see that in the X-rays. So this is measurement in the X-rays. Peaks in X-rays. So you really need X-ray observatories to see that, and X-rays can't be really measured on Earth. So you need X-ray satellites. And the X-ray satellites which are doing the measurements are Chandra. This was measured by Chandra. Chandra has an excellent spectral resolution, and by XMM Newton. And the power of XMM Newton is the receiving surface. So they are more sensitive than Chandra, but Chandra has the better spectral resolution, so they can really do a nice measurement of the spectrum. And Chandra is from NASA, and XMM Newton is from the European Space Agency. So they are already in orbit for more than 20 years. I think they started in the 1990s. There are follow-up missions, which is called E-Rosita, which will be up then in a few years, hopefully, from now. And a big mission is called Athena, which will be up in 2028. So you're going to have this, the certain slots for the big missions, and the next one in 2028 is reserved for Athena, which is an X-ray mission. Good. So perfect black body, this means no lines. no lines. So unfortunately, this doesn't work out. For white dwarfs, they can have always measurements of hydrogen Balmer lines. They can measure then a broadening and deformation of the line from gravity, and if they determine the gravitation acceleration constant, they get also a measurement of the compactness. So this doesn't work here. So that's the problem. There have been claims on, there have been one claim of measurement of respect line, but it turned out that it could not be reproduced by follow-up measurements or more precise ones. And that was an accreting neutron star, and in the burst they saw some spectral lines, and in quiescence they saw some spectral lines, and then they compared the two and inferred there was a shift of the spectral lines. But this turned out to be premature and shall not be taken as a clean measurement. Good. So the spectrum of RX1856 has been also measured by the Hubble Space Telescope in the optical. So you can just extend down the flux here now to low energies. And what one finds is that will be a mismatch. So the flux measured by the Hubble Space Telescope in the optical is a factor 7 off compared to the flux which you expect by extrapolating the black body measured in X-rays. So the atmosphere is more complicated, and one possibility is that there might be a hotspot and an overall surface. So there might be a hotspot which makes the high energy emission in X-rays with a smaller surface. That's why the flux is so small, and a brighter surface which is then at a lower temperature. So in the future, there is nicer. There's the nicer emission. Nicer emission. And that's a small satellite mission which is not orbiting itself. You know nicer? No?
No, the name is funny.
The nicer mission which has docked up at the ISS. In 2017, so last year. So they're already doing measurements. And what they measure is they measure the distortion from space-time. Measure distortion of a hotspot on the neutron star from space-time. Yeah. Again, what those people are trying to do is, of course, just to infer the distortions of space-time means that we just implement corrections from general relativity without really invoking some model. Yeah, and therefore, this is a clean measurement, and we hope that maybe this summer we will have the first data about the true radius measurement. There have been some constraints actually from the gravitational wave signal. And what they measure is the tidal deformability. And they measure this tidal deformability lambda was measured to be smaller than about 800. This is dimensionless quantity. And lambda is basically proportional to r to the fifth power. This means, in principle, this tidal deformability gives a constraint on the radius. And it turns out the radius must be larger, must be smaller than about 13 kilometers, thereabouts. And that's basically mass independent, that statement. Okay. There's also a lower limit from causality. Okay, let's make this plot again. Of course, there's a limit from the Schwarzschild radius to GM. There is a limit from the Buchdahl limit. Buchdahl. So R is equal, this was 9 over 4. Buchdahl. Yeah, this basically means that the pressure is smaller than infinity, so to say. The pressure cannot go up more than, there can be no singularity in the pressure in the core. But there's another one. This is this one here. This is this one, this is this one, this one here. This is the causality limit, and this we calculated to be 8 over 3. GM, the pressure is smaller equal the energy density. This is causality. Causality limit. And then there is another limit from rotation. And the maximum frequency we can have, has been measured is the period, the frequency. So the maximum rotation, the maximum frequency one has measured was 716 hertz. So if a star is somewhere here, basically what this line shows is the Kepler limit. Kepler limit from rotation. There's no mass shedding, and basically at the surface, the velocity must be smaller or equal than the velocity of light. That's the Kepler limit, which gives you that shape here. Goes like R squared. So anything out here is ruled out. Anything out here is also ruled out. And that, of course, from black holes is ruled out. So the mass radius curve must be somewhere in between. Yeah. Now we can infer for 1 and 2 solar masses the limit, 1 and 2 solar masses. Yeah, this is 3 kilometers, so 2 solar masses, this would be 6 kilometers, so this is at 6 kilometers, this value here. And this one here is at 3 kilometers. Yeah. And then let's take this limit here, so we have this is 3 kilometers, so this is 3 kilometers divided by 3 is 1 kilometer, is 8 is 4 kilometer for one solar mass, and then it's 8 kilometers. So this shall be here, this shall be here. This is not to scale, 8 kilometers. So the limit for two solar masses about 8 kilometers from the causality limit. And then only 4 kilometers here for one solar mass. That's the ballpark we have. Now the constraint here from the tidal deformability, it turns out that this is basically sharply peaked around 13 kilometers. So it goes somewhere here. We have a constraint here. From the tidal deformability. Thereabout, approximately. Good. So we have some constraints on the radius, but we don't really have a precise measurement yet. So and the curve can, of course, still start here. We have seen mass radius curves. So the neutron star can go up here and can reach a maximum mass of 2 solar masses. So this would be a mass radius curve which is compatible with all observations, right? You have to go in this regime, and one has to go, of course, above 2 solar masses, right? So one has to reach this area here, has to be reached this year. The mass radius curve has to go in this regime here and hit something above 2 solar masses. And from stellar evolution theory, everything interesting is, of course, between 1 and 2 solar masses. So this is the interesting part here. It has to be in here. And for sure, it also has to be in here. Good. So that's what we know about the radius of neutron stars so far. Any questions? That was a lot of information. Okay, then we make a few minute break, I clean the blackboard, and then we start discussing the structure of neutron stars. Does Dia come? Yeah. The structure of neutron stars. So we discussed several density regimes where we have different compositions of matter. So let's discuss this as a function of the mass density. So first of all, if the mass density is smaller than about 10 to 4 gram per cubic centimeters, that's the first thing. Here we have the atmosphere. Atmosphere, and it's really an atmosphere in the sense that we have atoms. And in many, many instances, one can infer that basically the atmosphere consists of hydrogen and not iron. It's not an iron atmosphere. It's most likely a hydrogen or maybe a helium atmosphere, maybe some silicon. And the reason being, twofold. So one is, of course, when a neutron star is born, there's fallback from the stuff from the supernova. So there might be silicon-rich matter which was produced in a supernova, which is falling back on the newborn neutron star. Or if it's an older neutron star, and even if it's stripped off the atmosphere, it collects hydrogen from the interstellar medium, which is mainly hydrogen. Mainly hydrogen. So the thickness of this atmosphere is a few centimeters. Ziemlich deutsch, oder? Okay. And the atmosphere, this determines then also the spectrum. The spectrum we observe is modeled by the hydrogen atmosphere. I mean, this is a huge density, 10 to 4 gram per cubic centimeters, compared to the density in the core of our sun, which is 150 gram per cubic centimeters. It's two orders of magnitude higher, that atmosphere here. And we know the mean free path is very small in the sun. And the same is happening here. So the mean free path is well below a few centimeters for the photons. So the photons make the last scattering definitely in the atmosphere before going out. So when we see a neutron star in X-rays or on the optical, these are photons which came out of the atmosphere. And therefore, the modeling of the atmosphere is entirely different compared to the modeling of a neutron star. So the next thing we have is from 10 to 4 gram per cubic centimeters to a density of 4 times 10 to 11 gram per cubic centimeters. And this is called the outer crust. The outer crust. And that consists of... Now, what is the energetically favored state? When we go to higher densities, the electron energy becomes so large that they basically kick out all bound electrons, so we have fully ionized stuff. We have a sea of electrons and a sea of nuclei. And the nuclei, of course, repel each other, and they form the structure which is most suitable for them, which minimizes the energy. So they have minimized the Coulomb energy, and this means you have a regular lattice which is forming. So it consists of a lattice of nuclei, so it consists of an electron gas and a lattice of nuclei. And that's the same for white dwarf. As for white dwarfs. Yeah, it's the same stuff as for white dwarfs. Here, somehow, contrary to white dwarfs, we can have, in addition to carbon and oxygen, we can also have all elements up to iron. Yeah. And iron 56 is the most stable one. But it could be helium, it could be silicon, it could be whatever. The most stable configuration in all cases, of course, would be iron 56. If we have beta equilibrium, if the crust is in beta equilibrium, it would be all iron. Yeah. Okay. So... the thickness is a few hundred meters. A few hundred meters. So it really depends on the compactness of the star. The more compact the star, the smaller will be the crust, because then gravity is stronger. And so it will squeeze it maybe to just 200 meters or 100 meter. If you go to less massive neutron stars that can reach up to half a kilometer or a kilometer. So that's a typical thickness. And then it has a solid structure. So this basically is responsible for glitches. Solid structure. And there is a plethora of phenomena in that region. So it can be responsible for the glitches, for example, which we discussed. So, okay. Then we have a critical density here, which is about 4 times 10 to 11 gram per cubic centimeters. That's the neutron trip density. Neutron trip density. And of course, I left out one density which we know from white dwarfs. If we have 2 times 10 to 6, I should write this down. 2 times 10 to if it is 2 times 10 to 6 gram per cubic centimeters, electrons are relativistic. This was in one of the exercises, right, where basically it means that the Fermi energy of the electrons is equal to Fermi momentum is just given by the mass of the electron. Yeah, and then one can infer that density. Yeah, question. Neutron trip, I come to this, yeah. So first, let's discuss beta equilibrium. There's a density which I call maybe rho beta, which is about, in if you do studies, yeah, let's put out some numbers. So it's about 10 to 7 gram per cubic centimeters. In this case, the Fermi energy of the electrons is about the mass difference between the proton and the neutron. Yeah. So of electrons equals mass difference of neutrons and protons. This means it is energetically favored. Electrons plus protons go over to neutrons plus an electron neutrino, but this goes out. So the mean free path of neutrinos for a cold neutron star is much larger than the size of a neutron star, larger than 10 kilometers. So, but this is now energetically favored, right? So if the Fermi energy goes above the mass difference, this reaction goes in that way. So here we have, maybe I should call it, this is neutron trip. Neutronization starts. So this means it's energetically favored to make neutron-rich nuclei. So up to this point, we have iron-56 as the most stable configuration. Yeah, so this means basically that neutron-rich nuclei are energetically favored. So instead of iron 56, we start to populate now nickel. Sequence of neutron-rich nuclei, which starts here. Neutron-rich nuclei. So if I look at the nuclear chart, this is the charge, this is the mass number. And then I have the valley of stability, which is a straight line here for light nuclei. Basically, Z is half times the mass number, equal numbers of protons and neutrons. Let's make it different. Let's make here the number of neutrons here. And then it bends over eventually for heavier ones. All right, so here we have Lead 208, a very stable heavy nucleus. Here we have then hydrogen, helium, oxygen, and or carbon, oxygen, and then eventually here we have iron 56, iron. And then the sequence starts to go from here. So instead of taking the most stable one, we take neutron-rich ones. So this is 26, then actually it goes to 28, which is nickel. And then it goes along the sequence of nickel sequence here. And then it goes along other magic numbers, and the magic numbers are 50 and 126. We are not here. The other one is 82, and then we have 50. And we have here 28 and 50. These are magic numbers. Now, another magic number is 20. And then for oxygen, we have 8. And of course, here we have 2. These are the magic numbers for nuclei. So in those numbers of nucleons, the shell is filled. So these are called magic numbers, 2, 8, 20, 28, the same as in atomic physics. Now, it turns out if you go to higher numbers, because of the huge spin orbit splitting of the nuclear forces, the magic number changes. It's not 40 or 70, it's 50 and 82 and then 126. These are the magic numbers. So this one has actually 82 protons. Oh, it's up here, 82. So the sequence goes now along 50 and 82. And then it jumps eventually to another sequence at 82. Am I doing this right? So if you draw some lines, then the sequence somehow goes like this along those magic numbers. So here we plot the neutrons, the neutron number, n. What is happening at that point is that we have reached the limit of stability. So there's some line which we don't know really, and that's the limit of stability. Limit of stability. So when we reach this nucleus here, the number of neutrons are so large that if we add one more neutron, it will not be bound. And that's exactly the density we have here. So if we reach that density, we have reached the end point of this nuclear sequence, and that's called the neutron trip density. Beyond that, neutrons cannot be bound to the nucleus anymore. They form a separate liquid. And that's happening at that density. That's also called here the neutron trip line. And people are looking for it at GSI and other facilities throughout the world to really explore the borders of stability for nuclei. Okay, so this is the crust, the outer crust. So we're having now densities in excess of 4 times 10 to 11, 4 times 10 to 11 gram per cubic centimeters. Rho up to a density of 10 to 14 gram per cubic centimeters, thereabout. That's the next interesting, and that's called inner crust. The inner crust. So for the inner crust, this consists of electron gas, lattice of nuclei, and a neutron fluid. And in many cases, that neutron fluid is superfluid. So superfluid means it can flow without resistance, and if you have rotation, that superfluid can form vortices, which can build up, and they are, this is one of the models for the pulsar glitches. Right. Yeah, so here we have transport phenomena, so we can discuss transport physics of a neutron star will be highly influenced by these inner crust and the outer crust, in particular from the neutron superfluid, which has a huge impact on the transport properties. Now on cooling, how cooling works, on the specific heat, on R modes, on the electricity, on shear, bulk viscosity. This is all determined in the inner crust and outer crust. Okay, so we need, the next is we have to talk about the thickness. The thickness is again a few hundred meters, maybe a little bit more than for the outer crust, a little bit thicker, but not much, a few hundred meters to be half a kilometer, maybe up to a kilometer, depending on the mass of the neutron star. A few hundred meters. What we can also have in here is a pasta phase. So the pasta and the crust, is it also called in the literature? And here we have, for example, meatballs. We have spaghetti. We have lasagna. We have anti-spaghetti and Swiss cheese. Anti-spaghetti. And we have Swiss cheese. All what you need for a nice American-influenced Italian dinner. Pardon me?
No, I'm hungry.
Close to lunchtime, yes. So what it means basically is that we have geometrically structures which resemble those pasta dishes. So we have holes, or let's say spheres appear, one-dimensional objects, rods, two-dimensional objects, or plates. One, two, three-dimensional spheres, rods, or plates, which can appear in the pasta phase. So this pasta phase is happening just at the boundary, just below the end of the crust, 10 to 14 gram per cubic centimeters. Below the density. Just below that density, just at the end of the inner crust. So if you make a picture of the crust, so here we have the atmosphere, then we have our lattice, yeah, then we have the one density where we have the lattice structure. Plus the superfluid. And then here we have the pasta phases. So this is 10 to 4 gram per cubic centimeters. This is 4 times 10 to 11 gram per cubic centimeters. And then here we have the pasta phase. And this is around 10 to 14 gram per cubic centimeters. Yeah, and then here we have the core. And this is the outer core. And then, of course, we will also have an inner core. And in the outer core, we have basically neutrons, protons, electrons, and maybe also some muons. That's the heavy partner of the electron. But most likely neutrons with a small admixture of protons and electrons. That's the fluid we have here. So, and that's the fluid of all this. So what is happening is that we now resolve this solid structure here. So we have one solid structure, and we have the fluid. And now what is happening is that we can have now a combination of those two. So we can have actually a lattice, and we can have regions where we do not have a lattice. So it's a first order phase transition. So we can have mixed phases of a lattice with a fluid phase. Yeah, and now it can happen that these pasta phases can have rods. So you start actually with balls. So you have one phase, and then you have balls of phase two. Yeah? So outside we have phase one, and inside we have phase two. So spheres of the liquid, the full liquid outer core appear in here. So that's the first phase where we have spheres, or the meatballs. Meatballs, yeah, that's the first phase. And then at higher densities, we can have now rods. So rods, that means really you have something like this. And in between, there's now phase two, and outside is phase one. These are the rods. Okay. And then we can have plates. So plates, I will draw like this. Yeah, so this is still phase two of the plates, and in between we have phase one. These are plates. And then the whole thing goes the opposite. So we have basically anti-Lasagna, so we have now plates of phase one. So basically phase one is here, and phase two is here. So in phase one, we still have the lattice, and the rods are lattice-free. And here we have basically plates of both. It turns around. So basically that phase, you can't really distinguish from the anti-plate. So in principle, I can leave this out, anti-Lasagna. But we have anti-spaghetti. So anti-spaghetti we should have, which is this one. So now we have rods going like this. So in here we have now phase one, and outside we have phase two. So the lattices form rods. And then the final one is where we have just bubbles of phase one immersed in phase two. Yeah, so we have just a few spheres left where we have lattices, and the other stuff around is a liquid. And then at the end, we reach then finally the core. Yeah, so again, here we have rods or anti-rods. Anti-rods and anti-spheres. Anti-spheres. Want to make another picture? Okay, so these are the pasta phases. And they can also have an impact on how neutrinos scatter through the crust to go outside, most likely also about shear and bulk viscosity. They are even, so this is, was computed with supercomputers to calculate really the rich structures. So other structures have been found. Also here at the University of Frankfurt, they have found very fancy geometrical structures called geroids, which is known from soft matter physics. Soft matter physics has really fancy structures, and something like that has been also found by simulating this pasta phases in the neutron star crust. Any questions so far to the crust? So this is just the crust of the neutron star. So we are basically maybe 1 kilometer into the neutron star. There's still 9 kilometers missing or more for a heavy neutron star. No questions? Okay. So whether these pasta phases really exist or not hinges on the details of how you model the nuclear forces and how you model the surface energy. Because those geometrical structures are just a balance of surface energy. So for the surface energy, we need input from nuclear physics and the Coulomb forces. So these structures are charged. These structures are charged such that, for example, here phase one is negatively charged, and phase two is positively charged. So here, this is negatively charged. This is positively charged. Negative charge and positive charge, and then it goes the other way around. So here we have now the positive charge and. Here we have the negative, this was wrong. Negative sign here, positive, negative sign here. Then we have the negative sign here and the positive here. And now finally here we have the negative charge here and the positive charge here. Yeah. But at the end, to this structure here, of course, everything is charge neutral within one Wigner-Seitz cell. It's balanced by the electron charge, the charge of the nucleus. And here, of course, then the electron balances the charge of the proton. Mixed phase transition to nuclear fluid in beta equilibrium. So here in the outer core, we really have the fluid we have discussed before, neutrons, protons, electrons, and so on. This we discussed for the Fermi gas and discussed the equation of state of that fluid. This is really happening in the outer core of a neutron star, above that density here.
Is the second phase always negative?
This depends on the details of the nuclear model. So in nuclear physics, if you look at a nuclear chart, so nuclear physics likes to have about equal amounts of protons and neutrons. So you need a high electron density, basically. This is favorable. And what we start here, we have neutron-rich nuclei. So this has a low amount of protons, which is unfavorable energetically. So the system tries to increase the electron fraction or gets rid of the protons, so to say. So it tries to make the whole thing negatively charged. So for those pasta phases, it is always the case because of the nuclear force try to balance the amounts of protons and neutrons. For other phase transitions, it might be different. So it might be that it starts actually the other way around with a positive charge and a negative charge interchanged.
But for the second phase is
to mix it up here. Yeah, this should be a plus sign and this a minus sign. The fluid is just neutrons and protons and electrons, yeah. The electrons are equally distributed because of the Compton wavelength being much larger than the structure of nuclei. They are equally spread out over the whole structures. So you just have different amounts of proton to neutron ratios in the two phases. And that gives you then the negative charge and the positive charge. So you can redistribute basically the charge, and this is energetically favored. This is why this structure appears. Okay. So I have already talked about the outer core, basically. So up to 10 to 14 gram per cubic centimeters, we have the outer core, consists of this fluid. The thickness is typically a few kilometers. For the low mass neutron stars, this can go down to the very core. So if you have maybe just one solar mass or so, then it can well be that this is just consisting just of neutrons, protons, and electrons down to the very core. The inner core, this is a big question mark. What can happen inside a neutron star, and this is what makes neutron stars so interesting, is that new phases can appear in the inner core of a neutron star. So this phase boundary is basically not known, this one here, that critical density here. And that critical density, this might be something like 3 to 5 times 10 to 14 gram per cubic centimeters. So this is about 3 to 6, or maybe larger, 3 to 10, 3 to 9. So 1 to 3 times saturation density, maybe 2 times saturation density, 6, 3 to 6. So about twice saturation density, there might be something happening. But we don't know, it might be higher, but definitely not lower than saturation density. Up to here we know the equation of state up to saturation density, which is maybe somewhere here, and to this point we don't know what's going on. The inner core can now consist of more exotic particles. What can appear are hyperons. This means lambda, sigma, xi hyperons. Or quarks could appear, quark matter. These are up, down, and strange quarks. But not charm quarks or bottom or top quarks, they're too heavy. So those particles can appear. Also, it could be, one has speculated that there might be some pion condensed phases or a kaon condensed phase inside a neutron star. Could also be possible, but the favorite ones at present are the hyperons and quarks, mainly discussed in the literature right now. And they have, of course, an impact on the mass radius relation. So this, the equation of state we have here from the outer core and the inner core are the dominant portion of a neutron star. These are really the inner 80 to 90% in radius of a neutron star. So they form really 99% of the mass of the neutron star. So this is what makes the mass radius relation, this stuff, the outer core and the inner core. So and this is where all the research is. So here we can really do a detailed modeling of neutron stars and look what the mass radius relation is. So, let's write this down, maybe on this blackboard here. So if we have 10 to 14 gram per cubic centimeters for rho up to about, I said maybe 2 times the density, this is about 6 times 10 to 14 gram per cubic centimeters. And this is a question mark, this density here, we don't know. This is called the outer core. Outer core. So, consists of neutron, proton, electron, and maybe muon fluid. But if muons appear, they're really tiny amounts of it. The most dominant portion, again, is of course neutrons, as we discussed in previous lectures. That's the dominant portion, and that's why it's called a neutron star. So this is where, this is the really the only place where neutrons are, maybe besides the inner crust, where neutrons are the dominant portion of the composition of a neutron star. That's why it's called a neutron star. So the thickness is several kilometers. Several kilometer, and might go even down to the very core of a neutron star. And this determines mass radius relation. For low masses. And up to, say, one solar mass. But again, this is not really known up to which mass it really goes, so this should be also marked with a question mark. This is about the typical range we are going to discuss here. So here we also have then a proton superconductor, a proton fluid, can appear. So this structure has important impacts also on the magnetic evolution and the magnetic structure of neutron stars by forming a superconductor. This can form now superfluid vortices where the magnetic field is expelled, so you can have vortices structures in the magnetic field in the outer core of a neutron star. This can form vortices. With magnetic field. Being expelled. Okay, last but not least, if the density is larger than about 6 times 10 to 14 gram per cubic centimeters, and again, this is a question mark where this density is, we have the inner core. The proton fluid is a superconductor. So the inner core consists of exotic particles. It's called exotic particles, but those particles we know in the standard model. In that sense, they are exotic maybe for usual astrophysicists who ordinarily do not deal with hyperons or quark matter. So these are hyperons. And we know hyperons, the lightest one is the lambda. Then there's the sigma minus. The sigma zero will can also appear. The sigma plus can appear. Or the psi zero or the psi minus. So the amusing thing is that with hyperons, we can have now baryons which have a negative charge. So the sigma minus and the xi minus can take over the role of the electrons. So the electron fraction goes down if hyperons appear, because they are replaced by those other particles. The problem is, whenever you populate new species, you lower the overall Fermi energy. You take high momentum electrons and transform it to low momentum hyperons. Yeah? You take away momenta. That means you take away pressure. So the pressure drops for a given mass density. So this will soften the equation of state. And we know what's going to happen if the equation of state is soft or if pressure is missing. We're losing the hydrostatic equilibrium. So most massive neutron stars cannot support it against the pull of gravity. So the maximum mass goes down. And that's also, and standard models see a drastic drop of the maximum mass of a neutron star when including hyperons, even below two solar masses, and that's called a hyperon puzzle. We'll talk about more about this. On the other phase which can appear are quarks, and these are the up, down, or strange quarks, up, down, strange quark matter. Now, this is an entirely new phase with entirely new features, so we don't know if the pressure goes down or goes up as a function of when we go from one phase to the other. Most likely, it has to be that the pressure increases when we form quarks. So it stabilizes the neutron star and can overcome the unstabilizing features of the hyperons. So there are even arguments that hyperons might push the maximum mass below two solar masses, so we need quark matter to push it up to two solar masses again. Yeah. Unfortunately, we cannot solve really quantum chromodynamics to calculate the properties of up-down strange quark matter in the density regime we have inside neutron stars. So we have to rely on effective models. The same is for hyperons. How do hyperons behave in dense matter? We don't know. We know how hyperons behave at saturation density, but not how they behave really at two times or three times saturation density. By the way, this density here is about, this corresponds to about two times the saturation density, which I quote here. And that here is about half the saturation density where we have to change from the crust to the outer core. So any questions about the composition so far? No? Good, then we stop here and we see each other then on Thursday for the exercises and the next lecture. The Swiss cheese is this one because this has holes in it here. These are the holes of the Swiss cheese. These are the meatballs. And the spheres are basically the holes. So these are the Swiss cheese.